I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm sitting in the arena across from my good friend Benjamin Alira Sainz.
And I'm sitting here in the arena as well, sitting across from my good friend Daniel Chacon.
Welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today on our show, we have poet W.S. DePiero. His latest book of poems is called Nitro Nights.
And it's another Copper Canyon book of poems. Copper Canyon Press does great poetry, and I'm looking forward to talking to him about it. I really like this book quite a bit.
It's an incredible book of poems, and when you read this book, you actually feel like you're living in San Francisco.
Yeah, that's true. It does take me back to San Francisco and all those weird nights I had walking around the Tenderloin, but we won't get into that right now.
No, but actually, his book of poems does kind of take you there.
It does. It really does. It really depicts San Francisco very well, I think. It's a fantastic book. You know, somebody said something to me, Ben, the other day. They said that they really like our show. And one of the things that they like about it, I don't know if you're going to believe this or not. Actually, I think you were there when this conversation took place, is they said they can't tell the difference when I'm talking and when you're talking. So during the interviews, when you say something or ask a question or I ask a question, they have no idea whether or not it's me or you. Do you believe that?
No.
I thought our voices were distinct and that people knew when I was talking, and that way they would easily identify me as the intelligent one.
Clearly you are.
No, that is absolutely not true. You're the brilliant one. In fact, I found out some good news about Benjamin Alira Sainz, and I want to share it on Words on a Wire. Your book, Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club, has been named a finalist in the Pen Faulkner Award. And that is big news for a fiction writer. Pen Faulkner Award is like right up there with the Pulitzer Prize. But the Pulitzer Prize finalists don't get what the Pen Faulkner finalists get. They're going to fly you to Washington. You're going to be involved in this nice kind of Academy Award type of ceremony. And they're giving you more money just for being a finalist than I got for my last advance on my last book. Congratulations, Ben. That's big.
Thanks, Daniel. I appreciate that.
You know, people are really responding to that book. You were telling me the other day it was a book that was really came from a lot of pain and that it saved your life, you said.
Well, that's true. And I think all of my books in a way do, but this one particularly. Sometimes we write because we need to write, and sometimes we really write because we're going through different things in our lives and we need to write to stay alive. And this book, that's really literally true. And we always make a joke at the end of our show. It's not really a joke, but you know, people can take it as a casual thing that we say that the next book you read may
save your life.
That's right. And sometimes the next book you write will save your life.
Yeah, and as you're writing it, it's saving your life day by day. That's true. Well, it's a fantastic book, and one of the things that you've taught me, we've been good friends now for, you know, many years. I've known you for maybe 13 years, but we've only gotten close in the last maybe 4 or 5 years. And one of the things that I've learned from you, I've learned many things from you about as a writer, but one of the things is, number one, you have to allow yourself to go where it hurts. And you have to be unapologetic about your passion and about your love. And I compare you to Lorca in that way. You are unapologetic about it. And if some people can't take it, the heck with them. But the fact is, you are going to go to the jugular vein. You're going to go to the jugular, and it's going to hurt.
I don't know how to do anything else.
And the other thing I learned from Benjamin Alira Sainz is to believe in your own work. I know that when my first book came out, I used to say, oh, well, it's a decent first book. And then my first novel came out, and I said, oh, well, it's a first novel. And anytime I say that, you would say to me, don't say that. It's a good book. Believe in your book. And I really believe that I've learned a lot from you about that. You have to believe in your work, because if you don't believe in it, the reader's not going to believe in it.
That's absolutely right. And by the way, speaking of good books, you've moved from being a good writer to being a great one with your last book.
Thanks, Ben. But I want to talk about you. I'm not done. I'm not done with the good news. We're going to get to W.S. DePiero in just a second. But on the same day that we heard that you were a finalist for the Pen Faulkner Award, we also heard that both the books that you had come out this year, Everything Begins and Ends at the Kentucky Club, and Aristotle and Dante Discover the Secrets of the Universe, have been nominated for the Lambda Award. Not nominated, are finalists for the Lambda Award, which is another big deal. They're going to fly you to New York, and again, they're going to do an Academy Awards type of ceremony. two books nominated the same year. I don't think that's ever happened before in the history of the Lambda.
I don't know.
I don't think it has. Congratulations. Your
Thanks.
YA novel and your adult fiction, both nominated for the Lambda. Ben, you are making Words on the Wire famous.
Well, thank you, Daniel. You're very generous. You're very generous. All I can say is that I write what I need to write, and I believe in my work, and I'm grateful to have an audience, and grateful, very grateful, and humbled that I've been nominated for the Pen Faulkner and the Lambda Awards. And I will say one thing on that part. I attribute my success to the fact that I live in this city. This city has made my career.
It's a great place to write. It is a great place to write, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Well, that's enough love for Ben right now.
All right. Stay tuned for W.S. Shapiro. We'll talk about his next book, Nitro Nights, right after this.
William Simone DePiero is an American poet, translator, essayist, educator, and art critic. He has published 10 collections of poetry and 5 collections of essay, in addition to his translations. In 2012, DePiero received the Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize for his lifetime achievement. In making the award, Christian Winman noted he's a great poet whose work is just beginning to get the wide attention it deserves. Welcome to our show, Simone. One of the things that I really appreciate about Nitro Nights, Simone, is that I really get the feel of the city in which you live. And I really do. I mean, it's almost as if, like, having, you know, lived in the Bay Area for 4 years and, you know, experienced San Francisco. But I think even if I hadn't, I really feel the city. And I really appreciate how you've done that in this book and how there's such a lack of romanticization about what happens in that city. But there's so much love and compassion behind that. When you started writing this book, did you see it as a book or did you just do it poem by poem by poem?
I never write a book of poems. I write poems. And then at some point, they seem to be falling into some kind of, not a pattern really, but they somehow seem to be occupying the same neighborhood. And that's when I begin to think about putting the poems into a book. I'm not the kind of poet who agonizes over the organization of poems, the sequence of poems. My most recent editor is like this, and a lot of people in workshops have this way of speaking about the arc of a book, you know. And I don't do arcs. It's like not part of my language. It's not part of my feel for. It's not part of my feel for the work that I do. I used to think that a book of poems, ideally, is simply, like in that very ancient sense, is just a garland of songs, a garland of speeches, like that.
So you don't print out all the poems and put them on the floor and look at them and say, what goes first, what goes second?
Oh, yeah, sure I do. Sure I do. That comes very, very late in the process. And even then, I think most of my choices are completely irrational. So that no one really could see any pattern except me, and I'm just imagining there's a pattern there when really there isn't.
Well, no, but it's interesting. It's interesting. I actually don't read poetry, anybody's poetry, in order. I'll read the first poem, and then I'll thumb through the book, and I'll like a title, and I'll read it. But I do think some poets do think like that. There's an arc, and I think organizations of poetry books are always in some way, it's not a science. We just kind of make decisions based on, you know, whatever. But do you suffer over the organization, or it just seems right, and that's that?
It just seems right. It really is instinct. More than plan. And occasionally, if I have a good editor, that editor might make suggestions. I published a book called Brother Fire, and it has a long poem about St. Francis in it. It's a very odd, formally blown out kind of poem. I didn't know if I wanted to put it as the last poem of the book or the first poem in the book, and that was a real issue for me, and I really could not decide. And so I let my editor decide.
And did he or she make the right choice?
It was Deb Garrison at Knopf. She's a brilliant editor. Yeah, she did. She said, put it in the front, let people know what they're in for.
Oh, wow.
Do you find, after all these years of publishing poems, writing poems, that your process has changed or has become more difficult, or has it become easier?
Oh, no. No, never easier. Never easier. I was about to say that my poems, I'd like to think, are maybe less driven by pain and conflict.
Mm.
And as soon as I was about to say that, I flashed on poems there. I just finished a new book, the manuscript, and I flashed on some of the poems in it. So I cannot say that I am no longer as driven by pain and conflict as I used to be.
I wouldn't say that about this book either.
I don't think you could say that. So it hadn't gotten easier. I don't know what hard means. Certain poems can be more, they make different kinds of demands. They make greater demands or different kinds of demands than other poems. Some poems are literally, you know, I wake deep into the night and there's language in my head. The language, I record it, and that language turns out to be the better part of a finished poem. But it's as if I am just some kind of nocturnal medium for the poem. And others are hard sometimes because I'm trying to find something, and I don't know where it is. But I know something's there to find.
You know, I'm a fiction writer, and I know when I first started writing fiction, I could start a story, and it might take me multiple drafts before I'm ready to listen to what the story wants to do and get out of the way. And another way of stating that, I suppose, is recognizing the form that the story seems to want to create. But as I got more experience, as I wrote more and more, I'm able to start a story and recognize the form a little bit quicker. So I don't spend so much time, like a year or two, on a single story. I mean, occasionally it's going to happen. And I imagine the same must be true with the poems. And is it easier in that sense that you recognize more quickly what the poem is wanting to do or where it's wanting to go?
I don't think it's that. I think it's practice doesn't make perfect, but practice really does matter.
Right.
So the longer one does it, the better your instincts are, I think.
Yeah.
And you have, I don't know what to call it, you have maybe a greater range of skills, and the skills continue to be improved. So in that respect, maybe.
Mm.
That's a hard question for me to answer.
Many years ago, when I had a workshop with you, you told me something that has really stuck with me because it really helped me as a poet. You said to me about one of my poems, I don't remember which poem it was. You said, Ben, don't you think this line here is a little in love with itself? And I love that comment because it helped me be a better editor, that just sometimes because you have an interesting line doesn't mean that it belongs in the poem. I don't suppose you have that problem, but I'm wondering, are there poems that you just simply abandon, or do you keep at it until it works for you?
Oh, Ben, there's a lot of wreckage out there in my past. A lot. I keep virtually everything so that it's always in my neighborhood. It's always here. But there's an awful lot of abandoned poems or things back there.
I'm glad to hear you say that. There's a lot of wreckage in my work as well. I find over time that it takes me longer to write poems, and I stay with a poem longer. Is that true for you, that you just spend more time in creating your work, or when you're writing, it just comes?
It seems, now that I am of a certain age, it seems, simply by the chronology of the books of poems that I've published, that there's a regularity, there's a kind of periodicity, insofar as I seem to have finished a book of poems every 3 to 4 years. I can recognize that now, and that pattern hasn't changed in the past 10 or 12 years. So, quite apart from my own feeling of, you know, struggling with materials and finding my way, it seems as if it probably hasn't gotten harder for me to do it, only because of the regularity of the books, the finished books.
I want to ask you one question, and it's not about the poems, but I also know that you write about art and you're a very fine art critic. Can you talk about that for a little while and how you got into that?
I can tell you exactly how I got into it. In 1985, I had the fortune of living in Bologna, Italy, a city that I had known already because I had lived there for a couple of years when I was a very young writer. And I went back in 1985 because I had a fellowship. And I was really exhausted from having written a number of books of poems, done a lot of translation work. But I'm always somebody who is writing something, and I've always had prose that I... And at that point, I had written a lot of prose about literary matters, about the life of poetry, about individual poets, about poets from in my past that mattered to me in my formations and all like that. So there I am in Bologna, 1985, and I'm sick of literature. I'm just... I can't stand to think or write about any of that anymore. And I wasn't writing new poems. And I've always been someone who hangs out in galleries and museums like everybody, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I stopped in a museum in Bologna that had a show by a son of Bologna named Giorgio Morandi. Morandi has since become an enormously famous painter, and he's a great one, and I've written about him a number of times since. Anyway, so I see this exhibition, and somehow it gets itself into my system. So I go back to the exhibition two or three times and find that I'm essentially in my head and in my heart talking back to these pictures. So I decided that because the work of critical prose has always been a way of answering to experience, whether it's art experience, literary experience, personal experience, walking the streets, whatever, that I would respond, I would answer, and try to write something about this painter. I'd never written about art.
That sounds like a healthy alternative to the Stendhal syndrome. Have you heard of the Stendhal syndrome?
Oh, I know what it is.
Yeah. And, you know, apparently, you know, Florence is is where it happens the most, but I imagine all over Italy it could happen. That you're exposed to so much art that you actually start getting dizzy, and you sound like you channeled it in a very positive way.
Oh yeah, and you know, art doesn't do that. I've written about the Stendhal syndrome, and I've never had that quite happen to me. But I saw this exhibition. I wrote something about Morandi, and I sent it to a magazine in the States, and they bought it right away. I got a telegram saying, "We love this. We'll pay so and so much money. What will you do for us next?"
And I think that's amazing because you weren't the least bit intimidated by writing.
They didn't know that I was not an art critic.
Well, you obviously were because they thought you were, and so you were.
And so from that point on, I became an art writer.
Do you read other art critics?
Oh, God, no. You know, there are art writers of the past that I read. Ruskin can be wonderful. And the great contemporary art writer is John Berger. He's just about as good as it gets. But I don't read a lot of that. I do, because I have no formal training, no formal education in art history, in order to do the kind of work that I have been doing, I've had to bone up a lot. So I read a fair amount of art history.
Mm. We're talking to W.S. DePiro. As Ben mentioned earlier, the city is all over this book, and I imagine even the city, the rhythms of the city might have at times influenced the language of some of the poems. But I'm wondering, what about the San Francisco poets, the City Lights poets? Have they in any way influenced the way this book unfolded?
No, I don't know them. You mean Ferlinghetti and... Gregory Corso, who's not among us anymore.
Yeah.
No, I don't. I met Corso once. We gave a reading together, and God, he nearly passed out on my shoulder. and I've never met Ferlinghetti.
Uh-huh.
There are a couple of poets in my neighborhood who happen to be my friends.
Uh-huh.
Tom Gunn, who passed a few years ago. August Kleinsaler lives in my neighborhood, and August and I go way back as friends. But that's about it. I don't hang with poets.
Or art critics.
Art right critics, yeah. Bartenders.
Bartenders, there you go. Poker players.
Yeah.
Why Nitro Nights? I mean, I love the poem Nitro Nights, but why did you decide on that as the title of the book?
You know, I think you asked me earlier about where certain things come from. And I'm sure I did hear some version of a word that has the phrase nitro in it when I was standing at a bus stop at the intersection of Haight Street and Fillmore Street, which is where that poem takes place.
Mm-hmm.
Once I heard or used that whatever version of that phrase was, that word was, it generated others. And so it comes, so nitro turns to nitroglycerin and to nitrates and to poppers and to everything that's sort of generated by that. That's how all of that happened. And Nitro Nights, that particular experience in the poem, Nitro Nights seemed to be appropriate. And that's where it came from.
Yeah. We've been talking to Simone DiPiero, author of, among other books of poems, Nitro Nights. If you haven't read his work before, in the age of Google, Google him. Probably has a Wikipedia page. I recommend his work highly.
Oh, and can I tell just a really quick anecdote? The other night, two nights ago.
Don't embarrass me.
No. maybe it might embarrass you, but the other night, Ben had Philip Levine over at his house for dinner because we had him for a reading, and I got a chance to sit and talk with him. I'm from Fresno, so I've known him for many years, and I said, oh, I see you blurb DiPiero's latest book, and this big glow just came on his face. He clearly has a lot of respect and affection for you.
Yeah, and I asked him the same question, and he told me, he says, well, actually, I don't blurb books, but apparently he'd written about your book somewhere. They got it from there. I forget where he told me he published it. And then the publisher got permission to put it on the back of your book. But I was very happy to see that Phil Levine is a fan of your work.
He liked my work before I knew that he liked my work. And I like him. And one of the more satisfying readings I've given was a reading in New York with Phil in that old club, The Knitting Factory. They have space downstairs where they had readings. And I love reading in clubs, you know.
Right.
It was really satisfying because I like him a lot and I admire his work a lot.
Wish we could talk more with you, Simone, but we'd like to ask you to read a poem to end our interview. And I have a request to make, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
I really like your poem, The Invention of Photography. Could you read that for us?
Yeah. There's a prison named in the opening of this poem called Moyamensing. And Moyamensing was a prison located in South Philadelphia. That's where I spent my first 21 years. The invention of photography. The adenoidal glass brick 50s. Tarzan featured on the cell block for Moyamensing's livid inmates doing their screening room shuffle. While Uncle P talked to a guard and I feared things that they did not. In the fearless 1850s, mad hatters forged images of dolls, doilies, sewers, 8-year-old odalisques, and over-the-shoulder 90s. Gentlemen Brits claimed their sphinx and Hindu temples. We had our civil war, rail cuts and silver mines, darkroom vans racked with plates, jerky mule feed cameras the Sioux called shadow catchers. Pull the lens cover, the ground glass blinks a century to a 2-minute wonderment when every decent family craved its Polaroid and waited to see what it would make of us, how inhale blood matter, lick it into life. The string bean screw says, poor creeps, and leads us through stone MGM Egyptian gates to sunlight's harsh hurrah outside. Shows off his sedan's crimped, toasted fender that Uncle P shoots for insurance evidence. Then, more evidence, a conversation piece. Me, guard, and penitentiary. I later found inside a drawer a Fox 60s print, a secret about a secret. Sunday morning, there they stand, fertile forms, grinning, hamming it up. Uncle, wife, and son. A standardized, toxic family, the squeeze box resolved into color, still a little liquid with the past. They stare into the yonder, with no hint of the old eternity we all heard so much about in the church conspiring behind them, or eternity's simulacrum, where convicts serve their time. Fast times now lead us through our small malarial wars for the millions, platoon grins, cemetery symmetries, a bullet in a flattened head, dead men's dumps, Pol Pot's carefully numbered portrait archive, the fallen and the disappeared from city towers, a double page spread, a yearbook layout. But now here we are in Sharon Meadow, pixeled in the viewfinder screen by an accommodating stranger. We and background congas and bongos, shrink-wrapped in the sky's irradiated green. We smile for the moment, filed away. Now, love, tip your laptop screen. Now we see us, now we don't. Digital daguerreotype spooks, chromed noses, iridium eyes, who fade just so to slate or silver. We lie in wait there for ourselves.
Thank you for reading that poem on Words on a Wire, Simone. It's been a pleasure having you on our show.
I appreciate it.
Well, that was fantastic. I really like that book, Nitro Nights, and I really recommend people pick it up. And I love the way he read.
Oh, yeah. He's a wonderful reader.
And just his voice. I could listen to him talk all day. That was
great. He's also a great teacher, though I think he's very humble about that, too. He can be a very, very humble man. And I'm glad that we could make our audience aware of his presence in the American poetry scene. This is what we do on this show. We introduce American writers to our audiences that they may or may not know. And so I'm very proud that you had this great idea to have a literary radio show so that we could give venues to other writers. Congratulations to you.
It's been a good run. It's been a good run. And Ben, again, congratulations on your finalists for the Penn Faulkner and for the Lambda Awards. That's really big news. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sainz. Thank you for listening. We'd like to thank again our fine producer, Norma Martinez. And we'd like to thank KTEP at the University of Texas at El Paso for giving us the opportunity to give you, the listening audience, this show. Thank you for listening to another edition of
Words on a Wire.
And remember,
the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on a tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire. It's a circus game with you and me. I'm up on a tightrope. One side's hate and one is hope. But the top hat on my head is all you see.